NPR.
This is your host, Samar Jarrah. Enjoy this lovely music. And as soon as we come back, we're going to listen to the rest of the conversation on BDS. This is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. Welcome back to True Talk. As promised, you're going to be listening to the rest of the conversation with co-founder of BDS Movement, the boycott and divestment of and sanctions of Israel. Omar al-Barghouthi was speaking via Skype from the state of Israel. He was prevented from coming to the U.S. to attend his daughter's wedding and to participate in this very lively discussion. So the best thing to learn about BDS is to learn and listen to the founder of it or the co-founder of it. And the gentleman who is talking to Omar al-Barghouthi is an American Jewish writer and author, and his name is Peter Breinbart. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org.
I want to ask more about this argument about Israel's character inside the Green Line, but you use the phrase indigenous Palestinians. I think most Jews, certainly many Jews, would consider ourselves indigenous also to Israel-Palestine. Do you agree?
The Palestinian nation was not ever a monolith. It was never a pure one group or another group. When I say Palestinian, well, some refer to Palestinian Arabs as indigenous to this land, have lived there for many, many, many centuries. We've always included Jews. I mean, Jews are part of our makeup, our history. So saying Jewish Palestinian wasn't such a difficult term. My grandmother, whose family was ethnically cleansed from Safed, her best friend was a Jewish family, from a Jewish family. And they did not realize that this family is Jewish or this family is Muslim until during the Nakba, until there was this division. But for many, many, many years, in fact, my grandmother's mother, and I've written about this, breastfed the my grandmother's friend, because her mother was not able to breastfeed her. And I don't know if you know, in Arab culture, and those Jews were Jewish Arabs, they're part of the Arab society. In Arab culture, if a woman breastfeeds a child, that child becomes equivalent to her daughter or son. So that my mother's Jewish friend became, in a way, a sister of kinds. So my grandmother's a brother, for example, cannot marry that Jewish girl because she's considered a sister of his. So, I mean, those were the relations pre-settler colonial establishment of the State of Israel. Jews are part of this history and part of this heritage and part of the indigenous Palestinian people.
On the question of Israel in its internal character, I know that you've made reference, I think, to the laws that have been chronicled by the Palestinian civil rights group Adala, the discriminatory laws. When I look at the Adala list, it includes some things like the fact that there is a requirement that there be a menorah on Israel's stamp, or that there be a Star of David on the flag, or that Hebrew must be used in government correspondence, or the Hebrew date must be used in government correspondence. So I think there may be an exception for Palestinians in that, or that there's a child vaccination law that you can lose child allowance, you can lose allowance payments from the government if you don't have your vaccinations, and that's considered discriminatory because I think some Bedouins don't have vaccinations as at higher rates. When I look at a fair number of these laws, they strike me as not necessarily that different in character than the kind of laws that one would find in European countries that we would find we would consider democracies, where you have a cross on the flag, where you have a preferential immigration policy for members of a certain ethnic group, or again, in the United States, where we have voting rights laws that I think many people believe in effect end up discriminating against African Americans. So again, my concern is that if one calls Israel an apartheid state inside the Green Line, even though Palestinian citizens can vote, is that not such an elastic definition that it could be applied to many democracies around the world, let alone Israel's neighbors in the Middle East?
No, it doesn't. It wouldn't apply to other quasi-democratic states like yours. The point is, some of those laws, you mentioned the softest mm-hmm. racist laws, but let's take the hardest ones. Mm-hmm. Israel defines itself as not a state of its citizens, but a state of the quote-unquote Jewish nation as an extraterritorial entity. A state that does not define itself as a state of its citizens does not exist anywhere in the world except in Israel. I cannot think of any other state that excludes part of its citizenry from its very own definition. The second point related to this is land ownership, the most important right. 93% of the land controlled by Israel through many basic laws. Basic laws in Israel, as you know, are constitutional laws. Through constitutional laws that where Israel, the government of Israel, contracted the Jewish agency and the World Zionist Organization, and through the Israel Land Administration, where the Jewish agency has Jewish National Fund, has massive power, these entities ensure that 93% of the land cannot be bought or rented by Palestinians, by non-Jews, in fact, 93% of the land. So Israel defines rights based on identity of its citizens. Forget the non-citizens, Palestinians in refugee camps outside or Palestinians in the occupied territories. I'm just talking about Israeli citizens. No, Britain and France have racism, but can we say they're apartheid? No, they don't have laws that discriminate against part of their citizenry. They might have emblems and symbols of Christianity and discriminatory aspects here and there, but do they have laws that disenfranchise a major part of their citizenry based on identity? No, they don't. Israel does.
And what about Israel's Arab neighbors? You know, Saudi Arabia, in terms of its treatment of the Shia population, or Copts in Egypt, for instance, do you think they would qualify as apartheid states?
No, it's a different type of discrimination. But Saudi Arabia, somebody can make an argument, for example, that women are suffering from some type of apartheid in Saudi Arabia. I don't know if anyone has made this argument, but I would subscribe to that, yes. Saudi Arabia is repressive against so many groups, including the Shia minorities, as you rightly mentioned, but mainly against women. Half society is discriminated against by law. So someone can make an argument there. But the UN definition wouldn't apply. The apartheid definition wouldn't apply. We need to find a new definition because it relates to racial group. And the way the UN defines racial applies to Jewish Israelis as a nation and Palestinian Arabs as a nation. It doesn't apply to women in Saudi Arabia. They're not a nation. But, I mean, it's very equivalent to apartheid, what women in Saudi Arabia are suffering from. And I'm not saying that because Palestinians are resisting Israel's apartheid, that means that there are no other nasty regimes around the world. There's so many nasty regimes around the world. But the one that's oppressing us is Israel, and that's why we're resisting it.
So given, for instance, that China is holding maybe a million Uyghurs in concentration camps of a site because they're not Han Chinese, you wouldn't lead a boycott of China. But if some people were to support to raise a boycott of China on the grounds that that reflects a kind of apartheid, you would be sympathetic to it?
Yes. As a human rights defender, I have to be morally consistent. If an authoritative voice of an oppressed community calls for boycott as recourse against an oppressive regime, I would personally support it. So if Yemenis were to call for a boycott against the Saudi regime, I would wholeheartedly support that. If women in Saudi Arabia were to call that, if any minority group being oppressed, occupied, ethnically cleansed, and suffering from a denial of basic rights were to call for a boycott, an authoritative voice of that oppressed group, it can't be just a couple of individuals or a couple of ivory tower academics. It has to be an authoritative voice. I would certainly support that because I truly believe, as Angela Davis says, justice is indivisible.
One of the questions that's been raised about the BDS movement is why the BDS movement does not take a position on the ultimate political settlement in Israel and Palestine. And I wanted you to explain why that was.
Sure. There's a matter of principle. As a human rights movement, it's beyond our mandate. We're focused on ending the three main aspects of Israel's oppression in order to have a possibility of self-determination and a just and peaceful solution, comprehensive, sustainable, just and peaceful solution. There's no way to achieve such a solution without addressing an end to the occupation, end to apartheid, and the basic rights of Palestinian refugees under UN laws. Now, that's the main reason. The second reason is much more, how should I put it, much simpler, actually. The Palestinian BDS coalition, which is the largest coalition in Palestinian society by far, it includes all the trade unions, women's unions, farmers' unions, academics, you know, just about every main entity in Palestinian society, cannot agree on anything beyond the three rights. Palestinians, as anyone would know, disagree on so many things. We have many internal debates. It's not just a Jewish tradition. It's very much a Palestinian tradition to have all these disagreements. So we stick to the three planks in the BDS call because venturing beyond that would not maintain the coalition. We would disagree. One state, two states, what the political solution should look like, it's up to the Palestinian people to exercise self-determination. It's not up to the BDS movement. We are part of the popular resistance, and we are the most important solidarity movement with the Palestinian struggle for rights, but we are not the leadership of the Palestinian people. We cannot make such a decision or envision what the political solution should look like on behalf of the Palestinian people.
So as a Jewish person who myself is engaged in many of these arguments with my fellow Jews, one of the things that I feel an obligation to do is when Jews reflect values that I think are contrary to my own, to say so publicly. Now, of course, it's different, I recognize, because I, as an American Jew, or if I were an Israeli Jew, have rights that Palestinians don't have. But given that there are elements in the Palestinian national movement like Hamas that I would assume do not share your values when it comes to women, when it comes to LGBT people, when it comes to the rights of secular people, do you feel that you have an obligation to publicly challenge them given that they don't share a vision of Palestinian politics and society that you do?
We have a responsibility and a moral obligation to convey our values and to spread our values in society. So we do not shy away from publicly expressing support for LGBT struggles, for women's struggles, for equality of all people, irrespective of identity and so on. We're not embarrassed to say that. We say it in all languages, in Arabic, in our speeches. We say that all the time. Some people do not like it, but tough. Those are our principles as a human rights movement anchored in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. If any Palestinian group were to take any position against a minority group, against a group that's entitled to certain rights, we would stand with others to oppose that. And many of us are active in so many groups. So it's not like the BDS movement has to address every ill in Palestinian society. And believe me, we have quite a few ills in Palestinian society. We're active in so many other groups. Each one of us is active in other groups, some in the women's movement, some in the workers' movement, some in other movements. Some of us are artists and dancers and musicians, and they fight for their right to free expression. When dance groups in Gaza are repressed, I, as a former dance choreographer, signed petitions condemning the repression of dance companies in Gaza, for example. So we do that, but in other capacities. We don't have to do everything from within the BDS movement because it's beyond its mandate.
So in 2003, the Palestinian Authority wrote a constitution. The constitution says in Article 4, Islam is the official religion in Palestine. The principles of Islamic Sharia shall be a main source of legislation, even though freedom of religion will be respected, and Arabic shall be the official language. This to me suggests a vision of a Palestinian state which in some ways is illiberal, privileges Muslims and Arabs over non-Muslims and Arabs. Is this discriminatory in your view?
I think it can be argued that it discriminates. And I personally would prefer something along the lines of the South African constitution, which I think is superior to many other constitutions around the world, where people are treated as equals regardless of identity. That's what I personally believe in. In the BDS movement, we have not taken up this issue. It was never raised, by the way, in the BDS movement. But I, as a human rights defender, and I'm speaking for myself, not for the movement, I certainly stand for equal rights, full equal rights for everyone, irrespective of identity. I would not support any discrimination based on religion, ethnicity, any form of identity, sexual identity, gender identity, or otherwise.
I came across a quote of yours from 2009, and you were talking about the vision of one state that you support. Because I understand, although the BDS movement does not take a position, my understanding is that you yourself personally are in favor of one equal state. And this was the quote. You said, this is in an interview with Electronic Intifada. I am completely and categorically against binationalism because it assumes that there are two nations with equal moral claims to the land, and therefore we have to accommodate both national rights. So I read that as suggesting that although you believe that Jews have individual rights, you believe that Palestinians, but not Jews, have national rights. Is that correct?
Okay, let me explain this. This might take longer than we can afford, but I can start to explain it at least. It relates to the right to self-determination of peoples under international law. In history, this right evolved, especially with the United Nations, but at no point in South Africa, in Algeria, under French settler colonialism, or any other situation, in no situation in history has any colonial community claimed the right to self-determination in a colonized territory. Self-determination is meant specifically to allow a group under oppression, a minority in a state, or a group that's occupied by a foreign power, or a group living an indigenous community under settler colonial rule, to fight for its rights. The self-determination aspect is the pillar of all other social, political, cultural rights. That's one point, the theoretical point. Now, more to the concrete question, Jewish Israelis do not recognize themselves as a nation. Nobody in Israel recognizes Jewish Israelis as a nation. In fact, the Supreme Court of Israel has struck down several attempts by liberal Zionists to have their identity as Israeli, their civic identity, in the registry, rather than as Jews. Because they were secular atheists and believed that they are Israeli. They wanted their civic identity. The Supreme Court rejected that. Knesset certainly rejects that. So Israel does not accept Israeli nationality at all. There is no Israeli nationality in Israel. It's the only country on earth that does not recognize its own nationality. It recognizes 130 nationalities, but Israel is not one of them. Because Israel defines itself as not an Israeli nation, it's a state of all Jews, of the Jewish nation. So there is no Jewish-Israeli nation to speak of, because Israelis don't recognize themselves as a nation. But assuming Jewish Israelis were to wake up tomorrow and say, we constitute a nation with a common history, a common language, a common culture, and so on, and we want to claim a right to self-determination. It never happened in history that a colonial community, and that's what it is, can claim self-determination in colonized territory. So what do you do then in a one-state solution, which is, as you rightly said, it's beyond BDS. BDS does not take a position one state, two state. I personally support an egalitarian, democratic state for everyone with equal rights. How do you deal with that? Well, as whites were integrated into the nations of Cuba and other countries where they became part of the indigenized population, if you will, then they exercise self-determination as part of the people, not as a separate supremacist group. Whites in South Africa, having lived there for more than three centuries, never claimed a right to self-determination as whites. Afrikaners never made that claim. With democracy in 1994, they became part of the South African nation, so they exercised self-determination together with the indigenous communities, the majority blacks. So that's the key point. The last point I wanted to mention, Peter, that you might object to, what settler colonial, what am I saying? Well, some honest Zionist leaders like Ze'ev Jabotinsky, as far back as the 1920s, said, and I have a quote right in front of me, I can read it, that we are colonizing this land. And it's normal for the colonized to reject this. And that's why we need an iron wall to drive despair into their minds so that they will stop resisting us. But he recognized that this was a colonial project.
So just to understand, so your vision, what you were saying is that Israeli Jews would become Palestinians and therefore would exercise national self-determination as Jewish Palestinians. Am I understanding correctly?
More or less. I didn't say Palestinians, but I said, a shared society with equal rights for all, including the refugees.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and you are listening to a lively discussion between Peter Breinbart, an American Jewish writer and author, and Omar El-Barghouthi, co-founder of the BDS movement. Please send your comments and questions to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org.
One more question. So one thing you probably, I know you spent part of your childhood in Egypt. My grandmother is from Egypt. And one of the things you just used to say to me when I was growing up, and this is something that one hears from Mizrahi Jews pretty frequently, is we don't want to be minority. We don't want to be a Jewish minority again in a majority Arab country. And I was surprised a bunch of years ago to find a quote by Edward Said. He was interviewed by Ari Shavit in 2000. And Shavit asked him, assuming that in this one state, Jews will be a minority, what do you think things will be like? And I want to quote Said, and I want to ask whether you agree with him. Said said about what life would be like for a Jewish minority in a one state with a Palestinian Arab majority. Quote, Said said, I worry about that. The history of minorities in the Middle East has not been as bad as in Europe, but I wonder what would happen. It worries me a great deal. The question of what is going to be the fate of the Jews is very difficult for me. I don't really know. It worries me. Does it worry you?
No, it doesn't. I think if you go back to Andalusia, the golden age of Jewish integration into an Arab society, the golden age of Jewish culture and philosophy and literature and so on and so forth, it was by the standard of those times, it was a much more homogeneous society, much more egalitarian society than the rest of Europe, where there were pogroms against Jews and systematic racial discrimination against Jews, not to mention massacres against Jews. In the Arab East, we did not face that same very violent anti-Semitism that existed in the West. So Jewish communities in several Arab countries have thrived in many different ways. Yes, there was discrimination. In several countries, there was discrimination. But as I said, it did not reach anywhere close to what was happening elsewhere. Now, even if one did not feel that I want to be a minority, a Jewish minority in a majority state, ruled by Arabs or ruled by Trump, I'm not sure. But regardless, I mean, is the Jewish minority in the United States feeling pre-Trump, feeling that as a minority it cannot coexist with this white non-Jewish majority, and blacks and Latinos, Latinas and indigenous and so on, Asians and so on? It's a matter of how you build the society, how democratic it is, how egalitarian it is, and how bound it is to the rule of law. If you have laws that discriminate, if you have policies that discriminate, and most importantly, if you have a culture, regardless of laws, if you have a culture of racism and discrimination, every minority would have a right to feel uncomfortable like your grandmother. But if we start envisioning a society with equal rights and an egalitarian culture that truly respects and celebrates difference and diversity, then people who are different should not be worried.
Okay, so we're going to go to the audience now. Do we have someone? Do we have a microphone? Okay, we have microphones on the right and left. So great. So why don't I just start on the left side? Why don't you just go over to someone who's close by to you? And we'll kind of toggle back and forth. And please make sure it's a question,
sure,
so other people have a chance. And ask Omar your question.
Thank you. My name is Nizar Farsakh, the Museum of the Palestinian People here in D.C. Personal friend of Omar. Thank you very much for this. And my question leads from where you just stopped. The theoretical answer makes sense, right? So that everybody is equal. In theory, in the US, everybody is equal under the law, but the practice is different, right? So as you said, there's the issue of the culture being egalitarian and respect for all the cultures. So from your perspective, what has worked with you? What can you share with us an example of you being able to convince a Jewish Israeli of that future in which they themselves, the Jewish Israeli, felt they would be able to express themselves and be free to wear the kippah, to respect the Sabbath, for example, and trust that the majority non-Jews in that country would guarantee that, right? It's not just the laws. And I think that's the main challenge. Logically, the argument makes sense. I'm not sure affectively it does. What has worked for you affectively and not logically? Thank you.
Are we taking a number of questions or shall I answer each one?
Let's just do one at a time for now. We've got some time.
Okay, this might divert the discussion from BDS because, as I said, my position on one state, two states is unrelated to the BDS movement. But I've written about my vision of one state. It was published in MondoWise as part of a Jewish Voice for Peace series of articles. So please, Nizar, you're welcome to read my article there. It answers that question, how to achieve this kind of culture that respects and celebrates diversity and celebrates the rights of minorities so that we reach a point where people do not feel threatened or do not feel coerced to act like the majority, and they cannot express their identity.
Great. Maybe someone over here. Yes.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first is on the indigeneity argument that Peter raised earlier. You spoke about how Jews who have ancestors have lived in Palestine for hundreds of years are Palestinian. But you didn't speak about Jews who currently live in America, but 200 years ago, their ancestors may have lived in Europe, and 1,000 years ago, their ancestors may have lived in Babylon, and 2,000 years ago, their ancestors may have lived in Palestine, and since Passover approaches, 5,000 years ago, their ancestors may have lived in Egypt. To where are those people indigenous? The second question is about Initiative 922 in Israel, which is trying to kind of collapse the gap between Palestinian citizens of Israel.
I can't hear well.
Did you hear the first question?
Not very clearly. No, there was a problem with the sound. It was a bit loud, so I couldn't hear most of the words. Sorry.
Okay. Well, let me try to rephrase it, and then you can tell me if I've gotten it wrong. I think the first question was, what about Jews who were not living in Palestine 100 years ago, but Jews who may have roots in Eastern Europe, but before then in Babylonia, and then before then, again, as Jewish tradition says, in what we consider, what we call the land of Israel. Are those Jews indigenous? Is that fair? Okay, why don't you try with a second, and Omar, if you're not hearing, just shake. Let me know, and I'll rephrase that. Go ahead. Slower.
The second question is about Initiative 922 in Israel, which is attempting to collapse the gap between Jewish Israelis and Palestinian citizens in Israel. Do you think this initiative is worthwhile and Israel trying to do the right thing? Or do you think this is window dressing and Israel trying to prove that it's supposedly liberal while in fact just ignoring the occupation?
Did you get that, Omar?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great. So two questions, please.
Okay, I'll start with the second. I haven't heard of that initiative, honestly, but it sounds like window dressing, sorry. As far as indigeneity is concerned, who doesn't have roots in Palestine? I mean, maybe some in China don't. I even doubt that. I think most civilizations have occupied Palestine, what's now historic Palestine. Who doesn't have roots? I mean, the Romans, the French, the Brit, everyone has roots in Palestine. Many had kingdoms for far longer periods than the Jewish kingdom in tradition. So who has a right? We're talking about the indigenous people who live there, who have the roots now, not based on some book that claims that, with all respect to holy books from all traditions. But we're talking about people who live there, who must have rights now, who must have equal rights now. There's international law to govern that. We cannot go back and every group from the Persians to the Romans and everyone in between claiming indigeneity in Palestine, because they would have a much more compelling case, believe me, based on how long they ruled the land that we call Palestine. So we cannot go to that level. And regardless, no one can exclude people living in the land from their rights just because of a claim that 2,000, 5,000, 3,000, 10,000 years ago, my community claims to have lived there. So what? You have no right to kick people out just because there is a claim that thousands of years ago you lived there. And just to give you an example of, and it relates to the issue of refugees that Peter asked me about earlier, while many Zionists reject the Palestinian claim to have a right under international law to refugees to return, the World Sephardic Federation won the right to have Jews from around the world who have ancestry in Spain or Portugal to go back after more than 500 years of being expelled. 500 years, and still the right is maintained for Jewish Sephardic communities to return to Spain and Portugal. But Palestinians who were expelled in 48, 71 years ago, have no right. What double standard?
Okay, the next question. Ma'am, right here in the front. Yes. Wait for the microphone. Just right here in the front. If you just bring down the microphone.
Thank you for having this. This is really interesting. My name is Ilhan Kagri, and I know we're not allowed to make comments, but just real briefly, I would urge people to go to Israel and the occupied territories, because you can't understand apartheid until you see it inside Nazareth and inside what's going on in Bethlehem and the other country, the other cities in the occupied territories. But my question is, I've heard that the whole settlement issue is really about big business. And that's why the BDS movement is so important, and also it strikes a big blow because it is an economic, it does hit what is really an economic movement, the settlement movement. So could you talk about the issue of the whole settler thing being about, or just the economics of the settlements?
Okay, among Israelis supporting BDS, there's an internal debate whether economics are more important than ideology in the occupation or vice versa. I think now with Israel's steady shift to the far right, especially with the current government that will make the 2015 government look slightly liberal in comparison, I think this issue becomes more or less settled. It's a combination of both, I think. There are economic interests, certainly, in the occupation. Israel benefits greatly from the occupied territories through pillage of water, minerals, resources, collecting taxes, selling us stolen water at extremely exuberant prices, and so on and so forth. Settlements certainly benefit a lot from stolen Palestinian land and stolen Palestinian water resources. And cheap Palestinian labor that's coerced, that has no other place to go except work. 20 to 30,000 Palestinians work in settlements because Israel has deprived them of their fertile agricultural lands, and they have nowhere to sustain their families without working in settlements. So they are economic projects. Now, BDS does not focus only on the economy. It sees a combination of pressures, academic, cultural, sports, economic, as well as military embargoes. But we have succeeded with quite a few cases of pressuring businesses to abandon projects that violate international law, especially in settlements. Admittedly, it's easier to target companies that do work in settlements because it's a clear-cut violation, and settlements under international law are considered a war crime under their own statute of the International Criminal Court. So that was an easier case. But settlements do not constitute a major business for Israel. The occupation does, but not settlements per se. They're not a major business for Israel. They are a source of income, but not a major source.
Great. Next question. Sir? Yeah, just wait for the microphone.
Thank you, Mr. Beinart. Thank you, Mr. Barghouti. I'm a member of J Street U at Columbia. And I heard you, Mr. Barghouti, when you came and spoke at Columbia. I was very impressed. I'm not a supporter of the movement, but I respect your advocacy for Palestinian rights. And I wholeheartedly support your free speech rights and your constitutionally protected right to boycott. My question for you, Mr. Barghouti, is how you square the fact that traditionally some of Palestine's strongest supporters and Israel's biggest detractors have been major human rights violators themselves. Nasser, Gaddafi, Assad, Maduro, the hardline theocracy in Iran. Now, to be fair, as you mentioned, many of the Israeli government's allies today are no friends to human rights themselves, Putin, Modi, Orban, Bolsonaro, and of course, Donald Trump. But it still remains the case that much of the pro-Palestine and anti-Israel activism around the world comes from religious organizations and regimes that have little respect for basic human rights. For this reason, many pro-Israel leaders charge you and some of your fellow BDS supporters with hypocrisy. Do you think, as a leading advocate for the rights of Palestinians, you would be on sure moral footing if you called out such allies for their own moral travesty and not allow them to sort of, you know, uncritically support you while they use the issue of Israel-Palestine to sometimes distract from their own repression?
Did you get that?
Thank you. Yes, I did. Thanks. Actually, if you're talking about the 50s, 60s era, the question of Palestine was one of the most popular causes of all oppressed communities, all people in the global south around the world. It was one of the main causes. Even after that, Nelson Mandela famously said that their freedom in South Africa would not be complete without freedom for the Palestinian people. And some international law experts like John Dugard, who's also South African, a judge from South Africa, said that Palestinian rights have become the litmus test for international law. If international law fails the Palestinians, many in the global south will feel that they've been abandoned by international law, that international law just speaks to the hegemonic Western powers, basically. So as human rights defenders, I take issue with the premise that most supporters of Palestinian rights, most support comes from religious groups and states. And so this is, I don't know where the premise is based on, certainly not on facts. In the BDS movement, the absolute majority, if not all of our allies, are those struggling for black justice in the US, for indigenous justice, for women's rights, for LGBT rights, trade unions' rights, student groups that are progressive. At NYU, for example, now we're hosted by NYU, not too long ago, 50 student groups at NYU succeeded in getting the student government to endorse a divestment, a very strong divestment resolution. 50 student groups. Those who did not support were, you know, some crazy right-wingers and Christian Zionists and far-right groups, basically. Almost every progressive group was with the BDS group supporting that resolution. Increasingly, we see that many, many connections are being created, especially with the black movement and the indigenous movement in the United States, and we're proud of that. So no, our allies are all progressive, are all involved in justice struggles, and we truly see our cause as connected, because without being united, there's no way we can defeat the ultra-right that is rising and the fascism that's rising around the world, from Tel Aviv to Washington and from Brasilia to Delhi.
Next question. Go ahead, to the on the left.
Hi, this is Sammy Tayyab. I have a question. It's a two-pronged question, but it relates to the same thing. So what should the BDS movement response be in relation to the increased normalization of it with Israel by the Gulf states, by the Arab Gulf, and as well as what should the BDS response be in response to proposed legislation here in the United States, anti-BDS legislation here in the United States in some states, such as Texas and New York, etc. Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, just to explain to the audience, because the term normalization is not readily understandable in English. In English, normalization sounds good. After states end a state of war, they normalize relations. It's a translation from Arabic, tatbi'a, which means making something inherently abnormal appear to be deceptively normal. So a relationship between a master and a slave is inherently abnormal. There should be no slavery. So if a master is dancing with a slave, it's never love, it's rape. That's just to put things in perspective. So Israel is trying to normalize relations with despotic authoritarian Arab regimes. As I mentioned, Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Bahrain, and others. And it's making some headway there. But does it win the popular support of the peoples of those countries? Yes, they're despotic, but it doesn't mean that the rulers speak for the people. In fact, in most of those countries, according to statistics from 2018 even, the absolute majorities in those countries, including Saudi Arabia, still consider the question of Palestine as the leading question for them, still consider Israel's regime of oppression as a clear enemy of Arab states. So yes, Israel can make peace and normalize relations with despotic regimes, but not with the people. Until there's an end to oppression, until rights of refugees are recognized, occupation is ended, and apartheid is ended, there's no way to have normal relations of everyone in this region. As far as the second question, the anti-BDS legislation in Congress. Now, most people in Congress are well-educated, but it just shocks me to read those anti-BDS legislation. That the number of lies and fabrications, and it's just horrific. Is there no fact-checking in the United States, for God's sake? I mean, can anyone just do a basic fact-checking? It's just amazing. And the second point, regardless of the fabrications, how can the United States, with its proud heritage of respecting boycotts as a matter of freedom of speech, protected by the U.S. Constitution, accept this McCarthyism, what the American Civil Liberties Union rightly called McCarthyism? We're living through McCarthyism 2.0, an evolved version of the earlier McCarthyism, where loyalty to Israel's far-right regime is the litmus test. And when states pass anti-BDS legislation, they're not betraying Palestinian rights only, they're betraying the U.S. Constitution, they're betraying your civil rights, and no one is safe. If they get away with this, if they get away with suppressing free speech on Palestine, who knows who's next? LGBT supporters, blacks, Latinos, who knows who's next?
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and you are listening to a lively discussion between Peter Breinbart, an American Jewish writer and author, and Omar El-Barghouthi, co-founder of the BDS movement. Please send your comments and questions to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org.
I want to go over here first, and then we'll go back.
I often hear BDS accused of not really being in favor of a potential two-state solution as well as a one-state solution, because the argument is made that since you believe in the right of return, an unlimited right of return, that will inevitably mean the destruction of the Jewish state. My question is, would you, in theory, be in favor of a negotiated solution with a limited right of return that was capped at some amount so that there was still a Jewish majority, but that remaining Jewish, quote-unquote, Jewish state would be a state of all its citizens and not a preferential treatment for Jews?
Let me try to unpack that. The movement does not take a position on two states versus one state. We think the three rights must be accommodated regardless of the solution. So even in a two-state solution, each state has to comply with its obligations under international law, which means that both states have to recognize the rights of Palestinian refugees to return. And this is a fact. This is under international law. It's not debatable that no state has a right to deny refugee rights simply because of a certain claim, divine or otherwise, to enjoy a certain supremacy. I, more than any other state, I'm on a pedestal above everyone else. I have a right to maintain a supremacy. No one has a right to maintain a supremacy. No one. If former victims can claim a right to supremacy just because of their past victimhood, the world will be a real, real mess. So no one has that right to claim any supremacy. No Palestinian in their right mind would accept a supremacist state in Palestine. And I think in Congress they misrepresented me. So maybe give me a chance to read the actual quote that I uttered rather than the misrepresentation in the congressional bills, both Senate and House misquote me. So I will read my full quote. And this was said in a discussion about one state and so on. I said, a Jewish state in Palestine in any shape or form cannot but contravene the basic rights of the indigenous Palestinian population and perpetuate a system of racial discrimination that ought to be opposed categorically. Just as we would oppose a Muslim state or a Christian state or any kind of exclusionary state, definitely, most definitely, we oppose a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. No Palestinian, rational Palestinian, not a sellout Palestinian, will ever accept a Jewish state in Palestine. Accepting modern-day Jewish Israelis as equal citizens and full partners in building and developing a new shared society, free from all colonial subjugation and discrimination, as called for in the democratic state model, is the most magnanimous, rational offer any oppressed indigenous population can present to its oppressors, so don't ask for more. End of quote.
Go ahead, sir.
Brother Omar, I have a question about the PLO. The PLO is right now probably more of an obstacle to the achievement of BDS's goals, three goals. And there has not been free elections, free and fair elections since I think 2006 or 7, right? What is the best approach to take towards the PLO from the Palestinian camp's perspective, in your opinion?
Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Okay. Afwan.
In the BDS movement, we all agree that the PLO is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, despite all the problems you mentioned. There is an integral, undemocratic tendency in the PLO. No elections, no democratic mandate. It lost a lot of its representativeness. It hasn't done any democratic work with communities, women, workers, farmers, teachers, and so on and so forth. My father was one of the founders of the PLO, and I remember how it was. It was never perfect, but I certainly lived the days when we had a lot of democracy. When I was a student at Columbia University, I was part of the General Union of Palestinian Students, and we were truly democratic then. There were true democratic elections then with various blocs and independents. I was an independent all the time, and there was a true debate and a true democracy then. We've lost a lot of that, but I think we Palestinians do not have the luxury of just putting aside the PLO and thinking of creating a new creature out of scratch. When we are so oppressed, so dominated by a hegemonic power supported by the US president and others, we do not have the luxury of abandoning our only embodiment of Palestinian identity, which is the PLO. We have to rebuild it, we have to democratize it, we have to reconstitute it to be more representative of all Palestinians rather than just abandon it.
I think, Omar, are you there? You froze.
Yes. Sorry, you did not hear me?
No. I think you had just finished talking about how you didn't have the luxury of abandoning the PLO. Was there more?
Yeah. No, that's it. I end on the luxury note.
Okay. I want to make sure other people get a chance. Go ahead. Yes.
I was really struck by your comment about the woman in the Knesset who said, as long as they love Israel, even if they're anti-Semitic, we like them. It seems that the difficulty in our country for the BDS movement is that the BDS movement is saying, we're opposed to the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. We are not anti-Semitic. We don't like the way the state of Israel is working. And yet the BDS keeps getting complaints of being anti-Semitic. So I find that, you know, how can it be so clear from an Israeli Knesset? How can that be used for the BDS movement here, I guess, is my major question. And is it also confounded by the fact that, as you're saying, Israel defines itself as a Jewish state, so therefore anything that might be opposed to the actions of Israel can then be turned to be opposed to Jewishness?
Yes, thanks for this. In fact, thanks to the work of Jewish Voice for Peace and more than 40 Jewish organizations across the world, this conflation between Israel and Jews is put to rest. Many progressive Jewish groups are fighting this notion, including some liberal Zionist groups in the United States. Some senators, some representatives in Congress have fought this. When Netanyahu famously came and addressed Congress and speaking on behalf of the Jewish nation, many Jewish Americans objected to that. I would say Jewish millennials largely object to this. Now, other than being historically wrong, Jews were never a monolithic group. No one can claim that all Jews are one and the same, and one can speak for them. I personally assert that such a claim is itself anti-Semitic. Anyone who puts all Jews in one box and say all Jews believe this or support that, or one group is representative of all Jews, is making an anti-Semitic statement, because it's reducing Jews to something that's not human. If you're human, you have diversity. Only Jews do not have diversity. That can't be. That's an anti-Semitic statement. So even when Israel makes that statement, that it represents all Jews, speaks for all Jews, it is making an anti-Semitic statement. And in fact, it is feeding real anti-Jewish bigotry. There's so many anti-Semites out there that would love to associate every crime Israel commits against Palestinians, be it a massacre in Gaza, an ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem, or in the Nakba, to claim that all Jews are responsible for that, because look at Netanyahu, he's saying, I speak for all Jews. But thanks to progressive Jewish groups, that claim is challenged. No, he does not speak for all Jews. There's so many Jewish groups that support Palestinian rights, and many who find what Israel is doing absolutely criminal and does not speak for them. So we should never fall into the trap of making this conflation between opposition to Israel's policies, even ideology, and attacks on Jews, as an identity, as a religion, as an ethnic group. That's absolutely racist.
Omar, thank you. I hope I'm going to turn it over to Jim Zogby to have the last word, but I hope that one day we will be able to have this conversation in person.
Thank you. Thanks, Peter.
I want to thank all of you who've come and those of you who are watching this being streamed online. And Peter, I want to thank you especially for coming down from New York to conduct what was a very meaningful interview. I really appreciated the questions. And Omar, I feel like as an American, we owe you an apology for what we've done. This is not just the situation where Omar can't come and speak to an American audience that deserves to hear him, but his daughter's getting married in a few weeks, and he was coming to the wedding here in the States. And if we do not push back, he'll miss that wedding. So I thank you so much, Omar. Under these circumstances, I think I would not have been cool, calm, and collected. You, as always, were. I think any of us watching this know why people wouldn't want him here. He's scary smart. And I don't know, but I think it's a good question, and I think we'll try to accommodate. Look, I urge you to support us in this effort to allow Omar to come to the U.S. Americans deserve to hear him, and he deserves a chance to be heard. You cannot have a situation where we are denouncing someone, misquoting them in legislation, creating a situation where I can see in the not-too-distant future a congressional committee opening with the question, are you now and have you ever been a supporter of the BDS movement? That's the direction we're moving in. And it needs to be countered. And it can only be countered in reasoned discourse and conversation. This is what we tried to do today. I hope we'll be able to continue it, and I thank you all for being a part of it. We hope to intensify this conversation as we move forward. Thank you very much.